This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We are continuing our conversation we had not long ago with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. Sheriff Martinez, thanks for joining us again here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you very much, Chris. Great to be on.
Let's pick things up here from, I guess, kind of where we left off. One of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about today is about the Drug Task Force Highway Interdiction Team. What is this all about? And give us an update on how we're dealing with our problems with crime as well as narcotics in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. What we did is the Highway Drug Interdiction Unit was dismantled about 7 years ago, just when the height or the peak of the opioid problem just, you know, started. And the interdiction unit, what they do is work on the interstates, Interstate 8094, Interstate 90, which is the toll road, I-65, U.S. 30, and also U.S. 41. And these officers are highly trained officers to detect possible criminal activity there on our roadways. And it's about making high-volume traffic stops. And their training and experience to detect possible drug smugglers or contraband or weapons. And it's been very successful in the past. Our officers have started to make some pretty good seizures out there. And it's pretty much a large bulk of narcotics. It could be heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, marijuana, that are transported in these vehicles, either through a suicide load, which a suicide load is the definition of drugs that are just placed in the cargo area or in the trunk, mm-hmm. pretty much no concealment technique used or effort to conceal. Or some of the vehicles are use high-tech, you know, elaborate traps that our officers are also trained to detect, where, you know, some of the narcotics will be concealed in the gas tanks and the tires, you know, and the a false bottom of the floorboard, the ceiling or headliner of a vehicle. You know, they spend a lot of money in these traps to get these drugs worth in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, that's being transported on our highways. But there's also U.S. currency, illegal U.S. currency that's being trafficked on our highways, the profits, the proceeds of these contraband or narcotics that is being moved, you know, to a source city, let's say Chicago, and then being moved back to the organization. And, you know, we've come across 400,000, 500,000. I know at 1 year our unit has seized in 2000, I believe, and 10, we seized about $1.5 million for the year. And
wow.
And that is, you know, great for the police department, great for the drug task force, and great for taxpayers because that money can be used for training and equipment when we seize the money.
Well, it sounds like that the Highway Interdiction Team is getting back into business again at certainly the right time here, as we mentioned earlier, the opioid crisis now at epidemic stages here in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely, and it goes further than just going after the drug traffickers and stopping the flow of drugs. As you know, we do have an opioid problem epidemic here in Lake County, as we do all over the country. And I believe Indiana is ranked number 17th in the country in the opioid overdose deaths. I know in 2016, we had, I believe, an approximate amount is about 114 overdose deaths in 2016. And the last year, we broke that record. I believe it was somewhere in the range of 180 overdose deaths. And that deals with opioid or fentanyl or heroin, and it's a major problem. So we have a major addiction problem as well, and we need to address that. So it's not just about going after the drug traffickers. It's not about just putting the drug dealers in jail. But now it's about recovery. It's about helping those that come through our jail. The addicts will steal from their own family to continue to buy this drug to get that you know, euphoria or that high, but when they're stealing or committing these thefts to sustain their drug habit, they're committing a crime, and we see them a lot in our jail, and that's a great opportunity where we can address this addiction problem, and that's the steps that we are taking in our jail, starting a program where we get a qualified candidate that can go through this program. Right now it's on a volunteer basis, and hopefully getting with the judges, it can be a mandated an alternative to prosecution for these addicts, a path to recovery, and going through detox in our jail, going through a program with a narcotic called Vivitrol. And Vivitrol is it's a narcotic that blocks the opioid receptors in your brain. So it lasts for 28 days, and you do not get that urge or want to get that the effects of opioids. And it works also for alcohol. So it lasts for 28 days, and I know we're partnering up with the organization to get Vivitrol supplied to us in the jail at no cost, because that cost Vivitrol is, you're looking at about $1,200 to $1,800, mm-hmm. and working a partnership with these other programs and organizations when they leave our jail, getting them signed up for Medicaid or any grants to continue this recovery process. It's, I think, our duty as leaders, as elected officials, and as human beings, to help this recovery process. They're not junkies. They're not. They don't deserve this. This is an addiction. This is an illness, and we're losing a lot of loved ones. People are losing a lot of loved ones because of this terrible narcotic.
We're talking with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez, Jr., and you were very referring to the problems with the opioid crisis that we face in the region, and how you're trying to deal with it there on the level at the Lake County Sheriff's Department and the Lake County Jail. Let's take a look now at the other parts of what happens at the jail in this particular case, and the inmates and their health care in particular. I know that you've been working very hard on getting some improvements to the health care process at the jail. Tell us the update there.
Absolutely. Well, right now what we have, every inmate that comes into our jail, we do start the process to get them signed up or enrolled into some Medicaid, so they can get that activated when they leave our jail and continue any of the medications or treatment that they were getting here in our jail. Another thing is our mental health ward or division, and we do have several personnel that are qualified mental health professionals. Now, one of the things about having our qualified mental health professionals, which we call our QMHP, is that they have some certifications. Now, we do have about six of them that are fully certified and licensed, and we have about four that are almost there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about, being the sheriff as an administrator is being fiscally responsible and making sure that everyone receives their certification. So one of the things I have done is I have reduced the pay on those four qualified mental health professionals to make sure they get that last part of their certification, and those who are fully certified get the pay, the necessary pay, or the pay that they deserve that's been budgeted.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I know we talked about last time and has come up lately here as far as improvements at the Lake County Jail is dealing with the search for you to have the right leadership, and in this case having the right qualified leadership. I recall last time that we had an issue here where the Lake County Jail warden had to be released because he wasn't quite qualified in that role. What's the status in trying to find a replacement for that position?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. It's going very well. We've done a nationwide search for a qualified jail administrator, which is a jail warden. And we're down to two right now. One is nearby around the Chicagoland area, and one that's from New Hampshire. And we're very excited. They seem very qualified, many years of experience in the federal, state, and local level. And we feel confident that within the next few weeks, if not next month, we should have one selected. And I'm very satisfied and proud of the selection process that we have done. And I think that once we come when we finally make that final decision, that he will be the best qualified candidate or individual mm-hmm. to be our Lake County Jail Warden.
That's great. And going along with being an administrator for the jail as a whole, I know one of the tasks they have is to make sure that the processes, not only in health care, but also the kind of food that the inmates get to have while they're locked up is important.
We do have our own kitchen here. The mm-hmm. food does get delivered here to our Lake County Jail. We do have a kitchen and cooks, staff here. Here and it's a unique situation. We're always looking for cost-saving measures or ways that we can do this in feeding our prisoners and making sure they get the proper nutrition that they need. So, you know, I'm looking at possibly contracting out a food service. Doesn't mean that because I'm looking at that there's going to be cost savings, but it's keeping our options open, and we're looking at other ways that we can save taxpayers money. But just understand that this is a large population of, you know, a little mini city of individuals here in our jail, and every single one sometimes required a specific diet, and we have to make sure that that is provided for them, or for any type of allergies or anything. It's our responsibility that, you know, they're getting the proper nutrition, that they're fed properly, and, you know, making sure that the well-being of our inmates here in our jail is top priority.
Finally, Sheriff Martinez, if you will give us an update on what you have planned here for the rest of 2018. We've covered a lot of things, and a lot of things, of course, are issues that are ongoing, not only the ones at the Lake County Jail, but dealing with the problems with narcotics in our region and the opioid epidemic. What else is on your agenda for the Lake County Sheriff's Department for 2018?
Well, like I said, the very most important thing is, you know, meeting the requirements for the Department of Justice, and I think we're doing that. And hopefully with the warden, that will be one step forward to getting from under the Department of Justice mandate. The next thing is where I think we're pretty close, as well as getting a psychiatric nurse practitioner that is required under the Department of Justice in our jail. One thing I'm proud to announce that within the last every month since I've taken office, our overtime has been going down in our jail, and it's about allocating the proper manpower and resources inside the jail to bring the overtime down, and that's important. The other thing is instilling the integrity and professionalism back into the Lake County Sheriff's Department and the organization as a whole. I can tell you morale is up. The men and women of this organization are excited, and I do see the support here within our own organization. And another thing that we're doing and moving forward is educating our public, with the opioid problem. We already did one class or one session here at the Lake County Government Center of Narcan training.
Right.
And what we did here is it's for the public. It's for the citizens. We are empowering them. So many times they feel helpless. And when they're calling 911, when they see their loved one, they're overdosed and not breathing. And they're waiting for first responders, either medics or police officers, to get there and give them that first dosage or shot of Narcan. Well, we're going out there countywide, training our community on the use of Narcan, empowering them. That way they don't feel helpless, and they can be that first responder. It's very important, that first initial, shot of Narcan to that victim that is overdosing. And, we're providing a lot of, things that we're going to do for our community.
Mm-hmm. And Sheriff, it sounds like a lot of great things underway. Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. with us. Thank you very much for today.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was great to be on.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana will once again have a presence at this year's Women's March Chicago. Ogden Dunes resident Joan Machuca who's a retired director of special education turned activist, is helping organize Northwest Indiana Women for the event, which about 400,000 people are expected. It'll be 11 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, January 20th at Grant Park in Chicago. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Joan recently about the march coming up this year, as well as last year's march and her organization efforts in Northwest Indiana.
You were pretty active in your retirement. Tell me about the Women's March Chicago.
Actually, I was one of the organizers from Northwest Indiana last year, and so I've been on their mailing list and have been in communication with the Chicago organizers for the Women's March for a year now. And they held a meeting last Wednesday in Chicago and invited organizers from around the area. So I was one of the representatives from Northwest Indiana. My husband and I both went. We were felt very privileged to go there to represent Northwest Indiana. And so we got quite a bit of information, flyers, and direction from their outreach person as to how to help spread the word about this most important event, which is going to be on January 20th. In Grant Park. Last year, we probably had, from Northwest Indiana, we had about at least 1,500 people in attendance. And as you know, they had 250,000 people attending the march. So we connected with a lot of organizations from Northwest Indiana and established kind of a meetup point so that we could represent, you know, the region. And we were really energized by the whole experience. It was so, so energizing. And from that experience last year, we've continued to formulate groups in the area. So it's not only been a great kickoff for us to be part of that Chicago experience, but it also enabled us to meet up with others and continue the experience of organizing, you know, within Northwest Indiana.
So when you had this this meetup point, did you all like meet up at a certain location and then just all the Northwest Indiana women went over on a bus or something?
We organized, and actually we appreciate it because Karen Tallien, our state senator, got the South Shore to add on at least 10 more cars to the South Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we asked people to, you know, to ride in on the South Shore, and then we met last year on the, we designated, I think it was the western point in Grant Park. And my husband made this great marker, you know, that said Northwest Indiana, and we held it high so people knew where to go, even if they hadn't ridden in with us. And so we all collected in that area. It was, as I said, very energizing, looking at the signs and just all the, you know, having an opportunity to support each other with the different, you know, concerns and issues that people were representing.
That was when everybody wore their pink hats last year right after the election, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That was, you know, there was a campaign to knit pussy, we call them pussy hats, those pink hats. So people would have knitting parties, you know, or people were making multiple hats so everybody could also recognize each other, you know, just by what they were wearing. So very fun.
The message last year was, and what do you think the message is this year? Can you tell us what it was last year and what it is this year?
Well, last year, I think, you know, it was mostly looking at how to help people to connect and become activated, you know, through meetup and looking at common concerns. This year, the message is to unite, and so we want people to become more united. And so one of the things I have done is I'm part of an administrative team. We started an Indivisible Northwest Indiana movement, and so we're meeting all of the Indivisible groups in front of the Art Institute, actually. All the individual, and there's probably going to be about 3,000 people just in that, you know, with those organizations meeting up. But there are many other organizations that we're hoping will connect as well and unite. And that's, you know, the Black Lives Matter, NAACP, Planned Parenthood, all of those groups, people that are dealing with issues that are, you know, human rights issues that also affect women's rights. So uniting is the mission this year, and one of the things that the organizers have done, and when we went to the meeting last Wednesday, I'm just so impressed with them. They had already printed out flyers, so we've got flyers in Spanish and English, We have buttons to promote the event. We have little note cards with, you know, the pertinent information that we can just hand out to people so that, you know, they can keep it in their wallet. It's the note cards say your voice and your vote matter, and it's got the website and March to the Polls, January 20th, 11 a.m. at Grand Park, so that people, you know, people can pass that out to their friends and we can increase the attendance. The focus this year is also on getting the vote, getting people to register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And just about every group that I'm working with right now, organizing with, there's two things that we're working on, and that's getting people registered to vote and trying to help people take away, you know, any fear that they have of doing that. We found that some people are afraid to register. So we're reaching out to groups and going door to door, canvassing, whatever, to help people to understand the importance of registering to vote and then voting. And then the other big thing that we work on all the time is holding our members of Congress accountable. So we're looking at what are the current bills or issues that Congress is voting on, and we do a call to action and ask our membership, you know, to phone in and discuss their concerns with their members of Congress. So those are some things that we do all the time. But, you know, uniting people together, I think, in this march is just such a powerful thing, because this has been a stressful year for people. You know, and people have become somewhat disenfranchised. So we want people to be re-energized by being with each other.
So the goal then is to demand laws protecting women and supporting women's place in power and just kind of supporting each other and showing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it just by everybody is encouraged, of course, to make signs. And if you look at what's on the signs, I mean, that pretty much tells the story for people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of issues right now with, you know, with health care. So, you know, there's concerns about Medicare and that being cut and how that would affect not only people with disabilities and the elderly and so forth, but it also, being a former director of special education, I'm very aware of how that would affect funding for schools, because kids with disabilities often have their services delivered through Medicaid. And so that's a big issue, you know, for parents. The migration issue is huge in this area. There's such a fear of deportation, and that's affecting, you know, our region more than the rest of Indiana, I believe. You know, if you go into the school districts, or if you go into Hammond, East Chicago, and Gary, there's a huge concern about, you know, what's going to happen, how lives are going to be affected day to day. So migration is huge. When I ask people why they would want to march, a lot of the women and men that we've talked to are concerned about their children and their children's future. You know, what kind of a country that we're living in, and how that affects the values that are being passed on to our children and grandchildren. So one of the things that this march does is empower people, because when we look at the signs that people are making, they're saying, we don't like what's happening, but we know that we can make a difference if we stick together and, you know, in our united effort to speak out.
Mm-hmm. To have a voice.
Yes. And that's one of the things that we want people to do, is to realize they have a voice, because when I talk to my neighbors, they're like, you know, very down about being able to make a difference. And so we constantly are saying, you know, if not, become a part of an organization that is doing something in a positive way, something that can make a difference, can make our voices heard. And, you know, so getting people to not give up, to join in is huge.
So you said that there's a lot of people who are afraid to register to vote, and is that because they're afraid of being deported? Is it the people that are, that their status is vulnerable?
Of course. I think that's one reason. You know, there's a huge disenfranchised population of people that have kind of given up. And one of the things that they're really, when I've asked why it's so difficult to get people to register to vote, there's three things that have come up consistently, and one of them is literacy, that some people are feeling intimidated by the voting process because they're not understanding the process. And that goes for, you know, several populations of people. But the Latino population, the second thing that they come up with is fear. They're afraid to register to vote because they're not sure what's going to happen with the information that they put down. And the third is that people just don't see that their vote makes any difference, so they've kind of given up. So our one of the things that we're doing with our organization, Indivisible Northwest Indiana, is you know, reaching out, trying to go into the communities and not giving up on those very, you know, disheartening reasons that people give us all the time. We're saying, you know, that's it's a sad thing to hear that, but that doesn't mean that we can't make a difference. We can. We have to look at different strategies and look at different ways to help people feel as though they can safely exercise their rights in this country.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
We are putting out flyers all over, canvassing every community that we can. So hopefully people in Northwest Indiana will see the flyers, and that will help them to give them direction as to what to do.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Joan.
Thank you for all that you do, Sharon.
Ogden Dunes resident and now organizer for the Women's March in Chicago, Joan Matuka. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's check in with Northwest Indiana political and community activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking again today.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure.
Well, I'll let you get started here. You've got your agenda. Fire away.
Okay. I have been reflecting on of, by, and for the people, and the failure in our democracy that seems to have gotten larger. And there's a lot of recent examples, not to mention, because I'm sure lots of people will talk about it, the president's comments, which were hair-raising in their racist clarity. And certainly a president who thinks that black people should not come to the United States and Norwegians should probably doesn't think that those people here deserve the same rights and opportunities as others. And that kind of went along with his promotion of making people work to get Medicaid. Now, I have a nephew on Medicaid who cannot work. The reason he's on Medicaid is because he's on Social Security disability. And to try and find or force people to work who can't work is criminal. But I want to mention a couple other things. I think a lot of the listeners might know that Peggy Hinckley, our emergency manager, now will be the person who decides on filling the vacancy in the school board. This public schools were kind of the keynote of democracy, that everyone could go, they were close by, they were available. We're about to have one high school in the entire city of Gary. Mm-hmm. And she is about to name the person who will serve on the school board, even though the school board does not have any authority or power. We are watching the death of the most important institution in our country. And with it will go democracy. The other thing that was on my list here is this lawsuit that was filed against the city of Gary because it passed a welcoming ordinance. Now, that ordinance says nothing about the city refusing to cooperate with the federal government, with ICE and immigration. What it says, which is part of the law, is that our police can't do the work of the federal immigration authorities, and it would be a violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution that says you can't commandeer local police forces to do federal work. And you can just imagine, with our shortages and our deficits, if our police were running around raiding 7-Elevens like ICE does, where would public safety in the city of Gary be? That is just another aspect of democracy, but it's more than that, because the lawsuit was filed out of Indianapolis based on an alleged violation of a state preemption law. Let me explain preemption. Yeah. It means state preempts, stops, overrides what local cities and counties do. Now, in our Constitution in the state of Indiana, we have a chapter called Home Rule, which says counties and cities should be able to make the laws to govern themselves. And certainly a welcoming ordinance, which is not exactly the same as a sanctuary city, was an expression of Gary's desire to be an open and welcoming community where people will move into our empty homes, will take jobs, and will help to rebuild our city. But this lawsuit says that we can't do anything if the state doesn't like it. And, you know, we have the same kind of preemption law on minimum wage. So Indianapolis says $7.25. You can't live on $7.25 anywhere in the state, but most certainly not in Northwest Indiana. Yeah. And so to preempt local home rule is about as undemocratic as it gets. So I'm very concerned. I don't think this lawsuit can fly. I think it will be dismissed because it stands on all kinds of weak and flaky ground. But anyhow, and then the last point that has bothered me, how can citizens of the United States, 6 months after a hurricane, still not have electricity in Puerto Rico? Are they not human beings, or does our president think they're like Haitians, and why do we let them come here anyway? This is another attack on human basic rights in our country. We have the right to be able to read, which you need light for, to live in comfort, which you need electricity for, and yet with all of our resources, the island of Puerto Rico is in the dark, and now the death toll is well over 1,000 because people are dying from drinking putrid water because they don't have electricity, they can't get water, and also they're dying from disease because they have no electricity and no access to care. So I think we should be very concerned in 2018 that if we do not get active, if we do not stand up and say this is not right, we will lose our democracy completely, and we'll end up with a little dictator who can tell us who can live here, who can't, who can work in our public school system, who can't. I mean, we will have no local self-governance, and we will lose our rights. So what I thought I would do, Chris, if this is okay with you, is mention some of the upcoming events that people could go to and get involved with.
Okay.
Does that sound fair?
Fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, the week of February 19th, I know that's in the future, but it's Black Labor Week, and it's part of Black History Month. But what is important is that Black labor in particular is facing really deteriorating conditions. Some people might have read about the Ford stamping plant where women, talking about the Women's March and Me Too,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where women are being harassed not only by the company, but even by the union. And the union is doing nothing. We need a week of education and service, because I think that the racism of our president has been the main thing to trickle down and to awaken really dehumanizing feelings and thoughts in our population. So I want to recommend that people go online to A. Philip Randolph, Northwest Indiana, and get the schedule for Black Labor Week. There'll be panels, there'll be movies, there'll be even a great celebration on Friday night, the 23rd. And learn about what is happening in our Black communities and in our workplaces. And kind of related to that, of course, is the march coming up on the 20th of January. It's called the March to the Polls. I think of it as a march for freedom and an expression of outrage, because it's not just Hollywood. It's not just people in big, fancy professional jobs. that face sexual harassment and assault. There's not a university, there's not a workplace, there's not any place, really, any institution that has not allowed pretty much the abuse of women. And it's even worse for Black women because they don't have the money to have the voice. They can't, if you are house cleaning, domestic work, where do you go if the male of the house attacks you? Or if you work in a hotel? There's a new program being launched by HERE, the Hotel Workers Union, called Pants On. In other words, if somebody comes to clean your room, she better not be attacked. So that march is Saturday the 20th in Chicago and in Indianapolis. So people need to really go out and express their outrage at what women put up with, and especially Black Latino women. That's one event. But before that, we have an event at Valpo University on Martin Luther King Day, and many people from across Northwest Indiana will be speaking there, from Black Lives Matter, from Trinity United Church of God, from the Calumet Strategy Group, and it starts, I believe, at 10 a.m. on the Valpo campus, and if you look on their website, you will get all the presentations and all the details. It's a day off. It's a good day to recommit ourselves to the struggle against injustice and war, because Martin Luther King stood very firmly on that ground. Then on January 28th, we are having a planning meeting at Purdue campus. We're going to do it both in Westville and Hammond and talk through satellite to plan the next demonstration at the airport in Gary. They have increased the deportations. There's no longer two buses. There's now three buses and other vehicles. They have taken protection away from Salvadorians, from Haitians, from Hondurans, and all of these people are going to be deported, and all of it for the whole Chicago area. The deportations leave from our airport every Friday morning at 10 o'clock. So if you want to come to the meeting, we'll be in Hammond and we'll be in Westville, and you can go to Northwest Indiana NWI Resistance and get all the information. And then on February 23rd, coinciding with Black Labor Week, we will be out at the airport to say no more deportations, protect DACA. And you might know that even the Ninth Circuit Court said, no, this elimination of protection for DACA causes irreparable harm and therefore should be overturned, and there's a block against it. The other event that I have, and this is close to my heart, we are going to put on an art exhibit called Art of Resistance and Resilience in Northwest Indiana. And we are looking for Northwest Indiana artists and activists. So your picket signs, your poems, your songs, your paintings, your photographs, anything you want to submit. And the jury, there will be a jury, but it's not going to say who's the best artist. It's going to look at how well the art reflects the spirit of struggle of the people in Northwest Indiana. And if you're interested, you can send a digital photo of your work or a copy of your work to my email at rneedle, N-E-E-D-L-E, at iun.edu. And the exhibit will be in March in Chicago and then in Hammond in May.
Wow.
And it should be very exciting, and it's about time that we got to look at and unleashed the talent of our people in struggle.
Well, that sounds like, too, that you're talking not only about artistic talent, but just talent in general for the feelings that person might particularly have for the topic, to be sure.
That's right. And so, you know, somebody asked me, can it be live performance art? Can it be, it can be anything, because our view of art is not a painting that appears in the Art Institute. This is trying to gather the spirit of struggle through what people have created in the course of struggle and in reflecting on our struggles.
Ruth, it's nice to hear these great comments, as well as the calendar of events here. In fact, we may get back with you again soon to kind of recap some things, or at least bring us up to date here on the calendar of events here, if there's anything new to add or to remind people about.
Yes, and I might even be able to drive soon.
Well, that's the reason we're talking on the phone, is because it was better to reach you on the phone than it would be to try to force you to work your way through.
Yes, I am thumbless, so to speak.
Oh,
I got a new joint.
Oh, geez.
And my hand is in a cast, and if anybody gets me angry, I could hit them with it.
That's right, and probably hurt them too, I would imagine, too.
So I would imagine.
We've been talking with Northwest.
Oh, I forgot one more.
Oh, yes, what's that?
February 11th. Okay. This is Sunday at 11:30. There's a bagel brunch at Temple Israel, mm-hmm. and the topic is climate reality.
Oh.
And there'll be someone, the rabbi who is in Houston helping out, will be talking, as well as a former resident of Northwest Indiana who was trained in climate reality.
Wow.
And so that's open to the public. You will be fed. You will be educated. Come join us February 11th at Temple Israel in the Miller section of Gary.
Well, that's duly noted, and we've been talking with Northwest Indiana political and community activist Ruth Needleman, getting a number of ideas and thoughts, as well as projects coming up and events coming up as well, too. And as we said, we'll get back with you here to recap some of these events as well, too, as we get closer to the date that they're happening. And as always, Ruth, thank you for being with us to talk about it on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, you're welcome.
Would you want an industrial waste dump near your house? Probably not. But hazards like waste dumps are concentrated near minority communities. And over the next few days, Great Lakes Today is going to take a look at environmental justice issues. Elizabeth Miller begins with a visit to Cleveland, a portion of that city that has a long history of contamination.
Marion Motley Playfields is a park on Cleveland's east side. Named for a local pro football star, it has grassy fields, baseball diamonds, and hills. But those fields hide a troubling history. Parts of the property were used as a storage yard for a brick and tile plant, and a stream became an industrial sewer. Vera Brewer remembers playing amid the debris with cousins decades ago, and the time an aunt came to get them and stepped on a rusty nail.
Had it been that we was not playing in the dump, she would have never had her foot injured. But that's where we played. That's where everybody played. We didn't know not to be there because of contamination. Our mindset was on enjoying life.
The area was transformed into a park in the 1960s. Its past was covered up and the stream filled with material from Republic Steel.
It's like a big park.
Especially in the
it's
fall.
It's huge. Yes.
On a recent sunny afternoon, James Miles walks through the park, reminiscing about his time spent there as a kid.
We used to call it the dump, but it's a field. We used to come down here in the wintertime. We get our sleds.
Today, environmental pollution remains. A report last year revealed metals in the ground, including arsenic and lead. The city's capital projects director, Matt Spronz, says those chemicals, along with many others, existed in soil samples and groundwater at levels higher than state standards.
Back in those days when people filled in property, whether it was in their backyards or whether it was anywhere else, there was no Environmental Protection Agency or Ohio EPA, and the materials they put into those areas were unknown, right, at the time.
Now officials plan to put a 2-foot soil barrier over the ground to keep kids safe from the chemicals. Playing in lead-contaminated soil can hinder brain development, especially for children. There are properties all over the country that were once landfills, dumps, or uncontrolled toxic waste sites. And these sites tend to be located in communities of color, according to reports commissioned by the United Church of Christ. Texas Southern University professor Dr. Robert Bullard was an author on one of those reports.
Racism trumps income and class when it comes to many of these environmental facilities that historically they've gone to the path of least resistance.
In Chicago, there was a toxic donut of landfills and industrial facilities. It's finally getting cleaned up, but legacy pollution remains. In East Chicago, Indiana, it's the USS Lead site, one of the most contaminated in the country. Nationally, the EPA reports that 45% of people of color live within 3 miles of a Superfund site, places highly contaminated by hazardous waste. And living near these sites can bring lots of problems: odors, noise pollution, and depressed home values. Then there are the potential health impacts. While it's difficult to prove a direct connection to serious conditions like cancer, scientists suspect living near landfills or waste sites can make people sick. And while there are thousands of Superfund sites, they're likely more like Marion Motley, not as contaminated, but still unsafe. Back at the park, Miles is happy the city is working to finally clean it up.
If there's any kind of contamination down here at all, I'm more than excited to see it finally getting the attention that it needs.
Meanwhile, other communities continue to fight to expose the unseen but lasting impacts of the region's industrial past. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Coming up in part two, a look at air pollution and asthma. Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of public radio stations WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester, New York. Time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, the music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And Kirk, we have a wonderful Valentine's concert coming up in a few weeks.
We do, and happy Valentine's to you, John, and everybody in our audience.
Well, I'm sure they're ever so grateful. So what's on the program for the Valentine's concert?
Well, we all chose the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony because it is the most romantic piece in probably the universe, and a favorite of our audiences. They have asked for it many, many times. I love, 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 using the Valentine's word, love. I love the piece, and the audience's response to it has always been, you know, over the top. So I can't think of a more romantic piece in the world than the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony. It's loved by everybody, I think, in the entire world.
I just think Rachmaninoff, his entire oeuvre is all that way. It's just the most beautiful, compelling. It just gets you all roiled up inside.
I loved compelling and I loved roiled because, you know, he's my, I don't know if you know this, John, but I wouldn't say he's the most perfect composer like Mozart, but he has always been my favorite composer.
Oh, is he really?
Since the first day I heard him in the Crow's Nest Pass, and I didn't know what it was. This older boy from college was playing in my teacher's studio, and I went and I said, "What is that piece? Is that Chopin?" And she said, "No, that's Rachmaninoff." And I said, "Did he write other pieces besides that?" And she laughed at me. And I have goosebumps. I'm not kidding you. I have goosebumps right now just remembering. And I've always felt like an enormous affinity for this beautiful 6'4", quiet Russian man who's just filled with heart. Just, like you said, compelling.
Well, I love Chopin and Liszt as well. But
I do.
But Rachmaninoff is there's just such heft to the music and the movement of it and the romanticism and of course the second piano concerto is my ultimate favorite piece of music.
Yes, it's just I agree with you. When I was a student in New York, I used to, when I had a little bit of money or my friends would take me in their cars, I would go to visit his grave up just north of the city, and I would sit there and sort of talk. I know that sounds, I hope that doesn't sound, but I just feel so attached to this man. He's so beautiful inside.
Rachmaninoff is buried in the United States?
Yes, he's buried just north of New York, like up on the Hudson, in a pretty famous cemetery with a very beautiful, nice space for him, like with a bench and three hedges around him. And, that's where he's buried.
Oh, that's
it's a pretty
neat.
Famous, like, several baseball players are buried there. And movie stars and things like that, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So what else is going to be on the Valentine's concert?
Oh, well, John, actually, although you said your favorite concerto was the Rachmaninoff Second, I know that you love the Beethoven Fifth Piano Concerto because you told me.
Oh, right? I do. It's not that. Yes, it's yeah. not as much as the Rachmaninoff, but definitely right up there. I just am crazy about the Emperor.
Yes, I am too. And it's this piece is one of those pieces. You know, he didn't write it near the end of his life. He wrote it in 1810, actually,
mm-hmm.
and he lived to 1827. But he stopped sort of playing the piano in public because it's one of those famous stories when he played. He was deaf, mm-hmm. and he would be way out of sync with the orchestra and all those things. But it is when you talk about romance in the terms of art, this piece defines now what is going to go forward with romance in you know, it's no longer Mozart or Haydn or anything like that. It is making the way for Brahms and Mendelssohn and Saint-Saëns and breaking all the mold and making all the revolution happen in music as far as a piano concerto goes. So in terms, it is very romantic.
And returning to play is Wael Farouk.
Yes, Wael, who was so popular with our audiences a couple years ago, and an astonishing fellow. I know that you had a very visceral and powerful reaction to him also, John, just as a human being.
Yeah, fantastic performer. We should just touch briefly because we have to tie it up. But we have a symphony gala coming up at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster on Saturday evening, February the 17th, which we're calling a concert with courses because in between each of the courses that for the evening's dinner, we will be having performances by members of the symphony.
Right. So first, we'll sit down and we'll eat. There'll be a big fanfare with the brass, and then we'll sit down in the percussion ensemble. We'll play four pieces for us as our entertainment and to show us how great they are. And then we'll eat something again, drink something again, and then our string ensemble will actually play some interesting, fun, entertaining pieces for us, hopefully moving to. And finally, after we eat again and drink a little bit more and enjoy each other's company, the brass will play for us. And so you get to know the orchestra players, you get to hear some really fun and well-played music, and it's important for the future of the orchestra too, because it is certainly a fundraiser.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kirk, for this opportunity to chat with you, and thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you missed any of the conversation with Kirk Muspratt, you can go to our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and go to Eye on the Arts and check out the conversations there. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.